Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and today's guest is a friend, a colleague of mine, and also a fellow ESPN expatriate, Sports on Earth college football writer Michael Weinreb. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Patrick.
So, we're going to talk some college football, obviously. First question, we've got four undefeated major conference teams left: Alabama, Oregon, Florida State, and Baylor. So here's what I want to know. Baylor? How is Baylor in that group? What's going on?
Well, the last couple of years, Baylor under Art Briles has just developed this offensive strategy where they're essentially trying to score on every play. And it's just a sort of a new way of looking at offense. It kind of even goes beyond what Oregon does. Oregon is moving, you know, Oregon's offense is moving fast. Everybody knows that that's kind of the thing about them, that their offense is moving fast. But I think there's a misconception that Oregon's offense is pass heavy, when actually Oregon is basically a hurry up, run heavy offense. Baylor is going to throw the ball downfield a lot more, you know, and it's a little bit inspired by what Mike Leach was doing at Texas Tech. But it just seems to have advanced on all those concepts to the point where they've had three different quarterbacks in 3 years. The first one was Robert Griffin, but they've had two other quarterbacks who have been just as good in this system. So something crazy is happening down there. I don't know if it's sustainable. I don't know if Art Briles is going to leave to take another job. You know, there was talk about him maybe taking the Texas job earlier this year, but it's pretty crazy how good they've gotten that quickly.
So you say they're trying to score in every play. I mean, literally, are they trying to take shots downfield all the time? I haven't watched them play this year.
I mean, they're not literally throwing downfield on every play. They also have a really good running back who briefly was at Oregon, who's averaging something, I don't even know, maybe like 10 yards a carry, because when they mix it up with the run, you know, there's just this huge swaths of open field for this guy to run into. But they have two really good receivers who can stretch the field, and they just kind of go after it a lot of the time. I mean, they're not throwing deep on every play, but it's about as close to a video game offense as we've probably seen to this point.
Okay, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the next thing I was going to ask you. I know, and we'll get to some more of this later. I know that you are somewhat of an avid college football video gamer, but you know, you and I are in the generation that grew up with sports video games and semi-realistic to increasingly realistic games. It does seem to me like that in all sports, the video game strategies that we grew up with, whether it's basketball games, bombing three-pointers, whether it's football games, not punting on fourth down and taking a lot of deep throws down the field, it seems to me like these strategies have been bleeding into real life because they're actually more efficient and they work.
Yeah, I guess that's the thing. You have all these sabermetric people and statistical people who are basically saying that all the things that we tried when we were in the seventh grade playing Tecmo Bowl are essentially better ways of doing things than the old ways were. So, you know, and I think some of it is obviously that the athletes have gotten better so that you can run these offenses more efficiently, both in football and basketball. But it's true. It's weird. I mean, maybe it's just like because our generation grew up with that stuff, there isn't this sort of, you know, the sort of grumpy complaint, you know, of the old school football coaches that, you know, three things can happen when you pass and two of them are bad. You know, that whole notion has kind of gone out the window. So maybe it is, I think it's partly a generational thing, and I think it's partly the fact that all these sabermetric type people are basically reinforcing all the ideas that we grew up with in the first place.
You know, it's interesting because college football to me always seems like a very tradition-bound sort of activity, and I think you've written about this a lot, but again, in the last decade, I feel like, how do I put this? The face of that has been torn off, so to speak. I mean, not just superficial things like Oregon's uniforms, but I mean, the way that teams innovate and the styles they use, especially on offense, but on defense too, it just seems like there was a period in college football where maybe there wasn't that much innovation. There was a lot of doing the same thing that worked over and over. And then things just kind of exploded. And now I don't always know what to expect. Is that a fair way to characterize it?
Yeah, I mean, as a fan, I think it's great. And I think the reason it's happened is because more schools are fielding football teams and more schools decided they wanted to get serious about football. You can probably trace some of it back to Doug Flutie. And, you know, there's the famous Flutie effect where Boston College's applications skyrocketed when he was in school there. So I think a lot of schools looked at that and said, well, how can we build a football team that's going to get on the radar? And so then they hired these coaches. They hired these young coaches, people like maybe like Mike Leach, who are sort of out of the box people anyway. And they say, you know, invent us a football team that's going to put us on the map. And so you have these coaches basically trying to figure out any way to compete with inferior talent. You know, it used to be that, like, there was no way for anybody to beat, you know, for an FBS team to, I'm sorry, for a Division I AA team to beat a 1A team. Forget about this FBS and FCS. I still get that confused.
Yeah, thank you. I get a headache from that as well.
Anyway, so for a 1AA team to beat a 1A team was impossible. And now it's like North Dakota State manhandled Kansas State. You know, so I think that between the coaches being more inventive, between, you know, basically being able to recruit from anywhere, every team being on TV at this point, it's helped even the talent pool a little bit. And it's also just that these coaches were just forced to do something. And so they just started thinking out of the box and thinking in different ways that, you know, football coaches are a pretty conservative bunch in general. But I think they've realized that a lot of them realized that they had to do something.
So for you right now, at this point in the season,
mm-hmm.
what's the most interesting or intriguing team that either you've seen in person or that you're following or that, just like I said, is the team that you make a note to watch and you're making a note to follow?
Team-wise, I do think Baylor is the most interesting team because it's going to be fascinating to see how far they can take that offense. They play Oklahoma on Thursday. That's by far their toughest opponent of the year. So it's fascinating to me to see. I mean, if they can go undefeated in the Big 12 and if they can sneak into the national championship game, I don't know if they can beat Alabama, but I would like to see them play Alabama. I would also like to see them play Oregon because there would be, you know, 200 plays in that game. You know, it would be the kind of national championship game that we've never seen before.
It's going to be like those old Denver Nuggets, Phoenix Suns, like 150-point basketball games.
Yeah, exactly. And I liked that when it was like that in the NBA. I liked, you know, when the Cowboys and the Broncos played earlier this year, and what was it? It was in the 50s, you know? I mean, I think that's fun to see. I wouldn't want to see it all the time in every game, but I think it's fun to see that.
So yeah, it might be better than 9-6 Alabama LSU, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the nadir of everything, I think. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of teams, it's definitely Baylor. In terms of individual players, it's still Johnny Manziel for me.
I mean,
they played UTEP the other night, and it was on at the same time as the Florida State-Miami game. And I found myself just as fascinated by the A&M-UTEP game as I did by the Florida State-Miami game because you just want to see Manziel play. You just want to see – anytime he's on the field, you just want to watch him. You just want to see what's going to happen.
So I want to ask you a little more about him. But first,
yeah.
You mentioned Florida State-Miami. We, like I said, the video game stuff. We both grew up in the 80s. And in the 80s and even the early 90s, Miami was kind of that, in my opinion, that most intriguing team, maybe the most polarizing team. They were definitely the team you'd want to watch or flip over to watch if you could. I mean, they were the U. You've written about them before. You wrote about them for Sports Center a few other week. They regained a bit of that sort of status and swagger, I think, about a decade ago, but it didn't seem to last as long. Are they even close at this point to being like the quote-unquote the U again? Or are there days of being that sort of swaggering, almost renegade NFL talent factory over?
I don't know if they're over. I don't think they're anywhere near that at this point. I think the talent pool is too spread out. I think they would have to win consistently for a few years in order to start bringing in those recruits that they used to bring in. And I think their coach came from Penn State, so he was a joke. disciple. So it's kind of ironic that, you know, that's the guy that they wound up going with. And I don't think he wants to run that kind of program. So I don't think with this, you know, current coach and under this leadership, I think they're essentially, as they often have in the past, trying to tack away from their image, you know, and they've tried to do that before and it hasn't worked. So maybe it'll work this time, but you know, I think you look back at those 80s Miami teams and what they did was really change the paradigm for essentially what people thought about college football. They sort of made the game a little bit more professional. And, you know, a lot of the ideas that I think you write about, I think those Miami teams helped clear the path for people to be able to think about those ideas in more complex ways. You know, the whole idea of amateurism and, you know, all the hypocrisies inherent in college football, essentially.
Right.
I think Miami exposed them that it was like, you know, 30 years later now, people can at least see that a lot of those ideas are corrupt and you know, need to be fixed.
Right. You know, college football, we're not talking about, you know, scholar athletes, you know, playing for the glory of the school and then going to get milkshakes after the game kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's, you know, there's probably still some of that, but I think the Miami teams, it was more like, you know, especially among the best guys, it was, we are here to go to the NFL. We think these rules that you are imposing on us, some of them are incredibly stupid. We think that we should be able to be demonstrative on the field, you know, and a lot of those things, some of those things we just kind of take for granted now. You know, everybody, all the kids are demonstrative on the field at this point. That's just part of the game, you know?
Sure. So in some way, even though Miami's no longer the U, we're all the U at this point. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Kind of, yeah. I think that's kind of the case. I mean, I think a lot of those ideas that they pioneered have been adopted by a lot of different schools.
So
it's sort of like, you know, Public Enemy, you know, being the father of hip hop, essentially.
Right. No, it makes a lot of sense. Again, you know, fight the power at the time was like a kind of a bold statement. Now it's like, well, sure, of course you fight the power.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Now rappers are onto talking about, you know, less consequential things, I guess.
So let's talk about that transition. You know, if Miami was kind of that. In some ways, I think that signature team of that decade. I feel like now, what's gone Alabama, not just success-wise, but just sort of culturally even, that they seem to me to be the signature college football program of this era. Do you get that sense? Are they sort of important in a way that goes beyond the fact that they just win and win and win?
Well, I mean, you kind of have to say that the signature program just because they've won 3 out of 4 national titles. But I think what's interesting about them is that they really are sort of a corporate football team in a way.
Right.
I mean, they have this extremely powerful CEO who's very detail-oriented, almost obsessively detail-oriented, it seems. And they just they don't tolerate any sort of digression from that, you know, from that sort of central power structure. So in that way, it's pretty interesting to see just how insanely disciplined they are. I mean, it almost seems unreal. You know, you always have to wonder what's going on under the surface there. If there's, you know, maybe it's less disciplined than we realize, but it does seem like Saban just kind of has his hand on everything over there.
Does that tack with the culture at large right now? Do you think it sort of reflects our times?
I think, in a way, it probably does. You know, I mean, I think that certainly there are, you know, a lot of people would say there's a lot of powerful corporations in public life at this point that kind of the corporate structure has become in the same way. Very buttoned up and very cautious. You know, Saban really doesn't have any need for the media at this point. You know, like he did that 60 Minutes piece, but like, you know, he doesn't really need to do any of that stuff. He's just gotten it to the point where he has just exacted such control over this program that it just sort of hums along like a machine, that he can just bring in almost any recruit he wants to bring in. So yeah, I mean, I can sort of see some parallels between, you know, the sort of overarching corporate structure of America at this point and what's going on with Alabama. I guess maybe that's a stretch, but I think maybe there's a little bit of that there.
Well, no, I want you to stretch. I mean, that's sort of one of the things that sets you apart as a writer. You're always able to take what's going on in college football and tie it into what's happening culturally. And I think that's important because I think in a lot of ways, that's what makes college football memorable. And that's what people sort of relate to. And maybe not even at the time when they're just watching the game, but when they look back on an era, when they look back on a team, they look back on a coach, there are those bigger resonances, right? It's not just, oh, that team won a lot of games, and that's all. That's the only thing that actually mattered.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. None of these programs exist in a vacuum. And especially what's fascinating to me about college sports is that you're getting these kids at a very interesting age. And so often what's happening on campus can be reflective of what's happening in the culture at large. I think Saban, just the control that he has over that program is still more the exception than the rule. Mm-hmm. Because I just think the way that the system is structured, and you obviously have written a lot about this, but it sort of encourages lawlessness. And I don't know what sort of lawlessness there is going on at Alabama. Obviously, they had that thing I can't remember which coach it was, but one of their coaches was apparently involved with some agents or something. So, right. I mean, you know, it's almost impossible for even Nick Saban to have complete control over everything.
Well, he's
the one who comes the closest to it at this point, certainly.
He famously, speaking of agents, he famously called agents pimps, which was a nice, fun bit of public posturing for a guy who himself, A, has an agent, B, has never been shy about using that agent to get himself the best deal in life and in his work, and C, I think if anybody in college football qualifies as a pimp, it's probably coaches like Nick Saban. But that being said, I am curious from something you just talked about with the corporate model and Saban's control and this sort of level of discipline. And we mentioned, you know, O'Bannon earlier. If it came to pass that we no longer had amateurism in college sports, how would that affect a program like Alabama? Would they just roll right into, okay, well, we're going to get our salary slots together and we're going to just keep rolling and doing what we're doing? Or would it totally blow up the kind of control a guy like Saban can have right now?
Well, it depends. I mean, we're talking about some sort of controlled system of payment for these athletes, I assume. It wouldn't just be the free market. It would be, you know, a salary cap of some kind, or that each player gets a certain stipend or something. Is that what we're talking about?
Let's say that just because it's an easier sort of thought exercise, let's say it looked a lot like the NFL. Let's say that there was some sort of player union, there was collective bargaining, so the players as a whole get a certain cut. Maybe teams have a certain salary cap, and, you know, endorsements are available to you if you're a player. Let's say it's something like that.
Okay. Well, I think Alabama would certainly have an advantage because they have this incredible booster system. But a lot of programs have that incredible booster system too. So I assume what they would do would just be to translate that, take that booster system and turn it into a way of recruiting these athletes and essentially selling them on the program, which is what they do already. Right, they would just be able to say, here's how much money we can pay you for coming to Alabama. Here's how many endorsements we'll be able to give you. You'll be on national TV every week. So essentially, in a lot of ways, it's the same system, except the athletes are actually getting money for it instead of getting scholarships for it. You know, I think they'd be selling them on the same sorts of things. I don't know how much of a difference it would make. I guess it would depend on, like, who figures out the loopholes in this system first. Because there's probably going to be some sort of loopholes in the system.
Right.
And a program like Alabama would probably be well-positioned to be able to take advantage of those loopholes just because the amount of personnel they have. I mean, the staff that Saban has is huge. You know, the amount of money that comes into the program is huge. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe it wouldn't make that much of a difference because the only – thing that's changing is that the players are actually getting money.
Right. I think you know, especially a place like Alabama, it would change almost nothing. I think probably for the whole staff there, it would be a fairly comfortable transition. It's, again, like you said, as long as there was some sort of structure, Nick Saban could then ensconce himself at the top of that structure to have as much control as possible. But he would still control the on-the-field stuff, and he would control playing time, and that sort of, I think that that would, that's kind of the biggest hammer that coaches always have in general.
Because if the idea you're talking about is that we can only pay each player this amount of money, plus whatever we can give them in endorsements.
Right.
Then there wouldn't be that much difference between going to Alabama and going to, you know, Florida State or something. Like, either way, you would still be able to get on TV. You'd still be able to get your endorsement deals. You know, it would just be a question. It would probably still be a question of who would be able to pay what under the table.
Right. Or if we had a total free market, it would still probably be the same schools that have the, you know, most resources now, which are the Alabamas,
yeah,
the USCs, those kind of schools. I think they would continue to be dominant.
Yeah, well, either way, I mean, if you do this, you're going to cut off a lot of the lower tier schools, which is why they're already talking about having a second division for those schools.
Right.
You know, which is, it's, I mean, it makes sense logically when I think about this. It worries me as a fan because I like to see those lower tier teams succeed. You know, Northern Illinois and Fresno State are both undefeated at this point. And, you know, it's fun to see those teams in the BCS. It's fun to see, it would be fun to see one of those teams in a 4-team playoff at some point. But I don't know if that's a realistic possibility at this point with the way the system's going to have to change.
True, although I think, you know, those teams, those schools, if they wanted to sort of keep on, and it was some sort of lower division, or just, again, not necessarily a lower division, but just we can't afford to offer to players what a school like Alabama can offer, much like is the case now. So we're not going to get the same level of talent across the board as a school like Alabama, which is exactly the same case now. And, you know, the thing with sports is that you can still sometimes, not as often, but sometimes still be competitive, despite having less resources. I mean, you see that in pro sports all the time. You see that in college sports now. I don't think it's a one way or another. I don't think, you know, a lot of people will argue with me, well, you have to keep amateurism just to maintain some sort of semblance of competitive balance. And I tell them, A, what kind of competitive balance are you talking about? There's not that much competitive balance in college football as it is. And B, I don't think you have to maintain amateurism or not. I mean, teams can spend a lot of money and still make personnel mistakes, and they can still be bad. That happens all the time. So
yeah, it's true. I mean, it does. It just does worry me a little bit because, you know, look at the NCAA basketball tournament, especially. Like, that would be, that's the thing where the upsets are obviously the biggest part of the tournament, I think. Right. Not everybody thinks that. Apparently, Jay Billis doesn't think that, which I don't understand at all. But, you know, I worry that things like the NCAA tournament or, you know, a North Dakota State beating a Kansas State, that would just never happen, or that those teams wouldn't even play because they wouldn't even be in the same division. So, you know, would it affect the upper tier competitive balance? No. But some schools would definitely be left behind here. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe some of these smaller schools shouldn't be starting football teams anyway, or shouldn't be putting that much into their athletic programs as a way to build the university in the first place. But I don't know. I mean, it's something that I think I'm not convinced either way what the best answer is in terms of competitive balance at this point.
Well, let's get back to that in a second. I want to ask you one more Saban question.
Okay.
There was a 60 Minutes feature on him last night. This will be broadcasting on a Tuesday, but we're recording this on a Monday, just in case anybody's confused by that. And I didn't think the feature itself was particularly surprising or revelatory. Not at this point. I mean, we've seen and read a lot about Nick Saban over the years. You know, there was a lot of talk about the quote-unquote process. There was this very quintessentially Saban-esque quote about mediocre people hating high achievers and vice versa, which personally I'm not even sure is true, in that I think all of us in America worship visual achievement, and we pretty much demonize failure. So I'm not really sure where Nick Saban's getting that from.
Yeah.
But there was one thing that caught my eye from a purely college football news kind of standpoint, and also from a humor standpoint, Saban seemed to hint that he's not going anywhere else, at least not soon. And here's the exact quote. Quote, "There's not the University of Mars, which is a better place. There's not that. So now it's easy to be comfortable here." Unquote. So I want to ask you three questions about this.
Okay.
One, why is Nick Saban the first prominent American to talk about Mars since George W. Bush's much-forgotten Mars mission?
Well, it's very admirable of him to think that we should start a university up there, you know? Maybe he's thinking, like, that's the first thing we should do when we get up there is start a college.
And play football.
And then maybe, we could start a bunch of other colleges on other planets and we can have an interplanetary football league. I don't know. Maybe he's a visionary. Maybe we're just missing this, you know?
Maybe he's got this incredible, like, habit for astronomy we don't know about.
Exactly. I don't know. Maybe he's got the whole thing figured out. He's already recruiting for the University of Mars. This is in the back of his head that maybe he's like, you know, someday, maybe in 20 years, we will have a colony on Mars and I will go there to coach.
There might be some talent. There might be some guys I can get.
Who knows? I mean, what if there are Martians? Then, you know, what if they can really hit?
So, second question, keeping on the Mars theme. Okay. Assuming you are Nick Saban, and there was an actual University of Mars, why would that inherently be an actual better place than any school on Earth? Because he seems to be implying that. No, he did not imply. He said directly, University of Mars, which is a better place.
Well, what's the gravity situation on Mars? I can't say I'm too familiar with it. Would you be able to fly in some way?
You know what? I think it's lower. I think you could probably actually throw the ball farther.
Yeah, see, that's what I'm saying. So maybe that's what he's thinking about. Maybe he's studied this. He's probably read books about Mars, and he's like, if we could play football on Mars, you know, I could actually throw the ball more than I do now, you know? Or I don't know. Maybe he figures he can he's probably got a whole playbook for the University of Mars at this point.
Just in case, because he's always prepared, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, you never know when the University of Mars might call. And might call his agent, you know, and maybe the University of Mars will be able to offer him big money, you know. Maybe they can offer him a lake house on whatever the University of Mars lake is. I don't know.
It might be maybe underneath the planet somewhere, hanging out with Arnold Schwarzenegger and the
exactly
and Quattro. What's the double Total Recall? Was it Quattro? I can't remember.
What's the biggest thing that can? What's the thing that can make him bigger than Bear Bryant at Alabama? It would be if he goes off and coaches the University of Mars. That's something that Bear Bryant could never do.
No, and wins a championship.
Well, exactly.
You don't go to Mars to finish like number fifth in the final poll.
Exactly. Exactly. If he finishes fifth in the Mars Athletic Conference, then he's got a problem. Yeah.
So third question.
Okay.
Texas. Texas might be the closest thing to Mars in college football, in my opinion, in that it's kind of its own country, just like Mars is its own planet.
Right.
And driving through Texas takes forever. And I assume driving across Mars also takes a really long time. So, how likely or unlikely do you think it is that Saban will end up in Texas, maybe next year? A lot of people have talked about that. And secondly, how much money do you think it would take to get him to move there?
I can't even imagine how much money it would take, but I have no doubt that Texas would pay however much money it would take. I wonder if the Dallas Cowboys would pay even more money. So I think there would be a ton of money in Texas for Saban. Like I wonder now that Texas is starting to win again. I wonder if they're going to might wind up having to keep Mac Brown for another year. If they finish strong, they might actually wind up having to keep him. But that's the thing. Like Saban could pretty much have any job he wants at this point. I do wonder if I don't think he would take another college job because he's already proven that.
Right.
The one thing that he hasn't proven is that he can be an NFL coach. You know, his NFL tenure was pretty terrible.
It was.
So, you know, I think I wouldn't be surprised if Jerry Jones just throws God knows a gazillion dollars at him and just says, do you want to do this? And maybe Saban thinks about it, wins another national championship this year. And says, yeah, right, what the hell, I'll do it.
I mean, that's an interesting idea. I have not thought about that, but you're right. I mean, What if Jerry Jones said, "We'll make you the first $10 million a year coach"?
Yep, and you will have complete autonomy. I will back away, which, of course, Jerry Jones will go back on his word eventually.
And that's probably the problem with him going to the Cowboys. It's the autonomy, not the money.
I think it is. I think you'd have to get some sort of promise out of Jerry Jones. But even if you get a promise out of Jerry Jones, that doesn't mean anything. So that would be the one thing that would hold him back, I think. But yes, I think Texas, your Texas Mars comparison is, probably going to get us some hate mail, but I think it's somewhat accurate.
Oh, I was just down in Austin about a month ago. I think they would like it, actually. Again, the idea that like Texas is so different and so unique, it's really closer to its own planet than anything here on Earth.
Austin's not in Texas.
No, it's not, actually. That was kind of like the fake non-Texas part of Texas.
Yeah, that's not part of Texas. Like, the people in Waco will disown Austin. So.
All right. Well, apologies to the rest of Texas.
Yeah. Don't mess with it.
And Waco.
Yes.
So, this season, it's the end of the road for the BCS. This is our last BCS title game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ever.
Yes.
Are you going to miss the BCS at all? And are all of us going to miss bitching about the BCS?
Yeah, I think a little bit. I think we're going to miss some of the incompetence of it. It was kind of fit with the whole nature of college football, where it's this sort of corrupt and messy and very political bureaucracy. I went back and wrote this summer, and I'm working on a book that has a lot of these same ideas that kind of looks at the history of college football and just how messy it really is and how politically driven it was. And it's kind of a nice metaphor for America in a lot of ways.
Right.
So, but there will still be arguments about the playoff. There, now that there's a playoff committee, there will be people who would direct their anger toward the playoff committee. But just the general limitations of the BCS and the fact that like the BCS refused to acknowledge its limitations and tried to hire people like Ari Fleischer in order to cover up its limitations, that it was this, they kept launching these PR initiatives to pump up the BCS. That was fun. That was pretty funny.
That's like the equivalent of hiring Lanny Davis. Like, if you're hiring Ari Fleischer, and all apologies to Ari Fleischer, so I'm sure he's very competent at his job, but you look at the kinds of things he's had to go out and spin for over the years. He's had to spin for the Iraq War. He's had to spin for sort of the Bush presidency, which was a disaster in a lot of ways. He's had to spin for the BCS. I think he did some spinning for A-Rod at some point. A series of tough gigs for a PR professional.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And somebody's got to defend the indefensible, I guess. So, he did his best, but...
it wasn't enough.
Yeah, I mean, nobody was going to save the BCS. That thing... Well, actually, and the weird thing is that was a big step up from what it was before. Because before, it was just completely political.
Right.
Before, it was just... Well, this coach hasn't won a national championship before. Let's give it to him this year, Bear Bryant probably deserves it this year. Let's give it to him, So before the BCS, there was nothing. So at least the BCS was something, even if it was something incredibly stupid and limited.
Well, you talk about the limitations of the BCS. How much is this new playoff system and committee really going to take us past that? Is it just a matter of, now we've got four teams instead of two, or is there actually more to it that will make this better than it's been?
No, it's pretty much we've got four teams instead of two.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so, but the odds of screwing up between a fourth and a fifth team are a lot less than the odds of screwing up between a second and a third team. So that's where the controversy is now going to lie, is with a fifth place team. And... there are some years where maybe a fifth place team could actually win the national championship. But a lot of times, you look at this year and there's probably four teams that could win the national championship. I don't know. Maybe there's a couple others down there. There's probably teams that have lost a couple games that I could actually, like LSU could probably, in a four-team playoff could probably win the national championship. But in general, I think that's the main thing is that it's four teams instead of two. I don't know. Maybe the committee, I mean, the committee, I guess, will be somewhat more objective because it will have more voices, because it won't just be driven by what's going to make the most money or, a bunch of sports writers in Georgia think about a team from Oregon that maybe they've seen play once the whole year. So it'll be a little bit more objective, I guess. But they're still going to have to make the same decisions.
Well, speaking of that, speaking of those sports writers in Georgia, or sports writers in the South, or sports writers on the East Coast, or the East Coast sort of sports media machine, including ESPN, where we used to work, although they have a significant Los Angeles presence now. Is the biggest part of Condoleezza Rice being on the committee that she's Condoleezza Rice, or is it that she's out west and actually familiar with Stanford, with Oregon, with sort of Pac-12 and West Coast football?
Well, I was kind of impressed. There was a story about her, it might have been in the New York Times, that she basically sits around and watches college football all day on Saturdays. And that's basically the main job description. If you're a smart person who watches a lot of college football, you should be able to do this job. And then you can bring in people who help crunch numbers. Computer polls and analytics and those sorts of things. But I think the main job is just to get 12 relatively objective or as objective as possible people in a room. I can't remember if it's 12, maybe it's fewer than that. But anyway, a certain number of people in a room and just have them talking about college football, people who watch a lot of college football.
Are you lobbying for a job on the committee at some point? Is this your stump speech? Is this your announce your candidacy announcement?
There is a former sports writer on the committee, and I don't blame them for not wanting to have a current sports writer on the committee. We're all sort of misanthropes anyway. But yeah, I don't think there's that much more to it. I don't think you have to like. I mean, what else are you going to do? You're essentially most of the time comparing apples and oranges because the teams haven't played each other. So, when it gets down to that fourth team and the fifth team, it's going to be, you're going to have to use some sort of measurable number or, some sort of statistic to figure this out. And it's going to come down to those anyway. So you might as well just have the people in the room who have watched the most football and are the smartest and are willing to be as open-minded as possible about this stuff.
Right, so we want to have stats plus that eye test. You want to have sort of that money ball balance of the
Yeah,
money ball analysis, but you want sort of the old school scouting as well.
I think that's what the NCAA tournament committee does, and they generally do pretty well.
They do, actually.
There's usually a couple bubble teams that are left out where you think, well, that team probably should have gotten in, but it's not the end of the world, And it'll be different because there's only four teams in this playoff. I'd like to see them expanded to at least eight eventually, so that
That'll
then.
happen. That'll happen 100%. Too much money for it not to happen.
Yeah, and then you could bring in, Northern Illinois and Fresno State and have them in this too, so that there would be sort of an underdog component to the whole thing.
Right. No, again, and also there's a lot of money in that because if one of those underdogs wins just once, that's going to make the whole thing so much more popular.
Right, and I think the small schools would like that because they figure, well, that's our lottery ticket right there.
Right. Right. No, that makes a lot of sense. And good comparison to the NCAA tournament. Let me ask you this, which is something that just popped in my head. We're going to keep, I guess we're going to be keeping still a lot of these bowl games because we have a lot of sort of TV inventory to fill in December and early January.
Keep spawning more bowl games.
Yeah, exactly. How about a college football NIT for those bubble teams? Can we have another four-team tournament with the next four?
I would totally watch that. That's not
I
a bad
think people would
idea.
totally watch that too.
You should write that up, man. I feel like somebody would jump all over that.
What really? What's stopping some enterprising? What's stopping someone like Mark Cuban from getting some investors together, hooking up with Jerry Jones? Maybe getting the co getting his stadium available if there's an open dates. We're getting some stadiums in Texas available, or some of the Rose Bowl, or somewhere. What's stopping someone from doing that?
I don't know. Start it up. Start the proposal. We can start the Sports on Earth National Invitational College Football Tournament.
I love the idea.
Yeah, I think that works. I know I would watch it, but I would watch pretty much anything. I'll probably watch the the bowl game that's in like Honduras or whatever they want.
Well, I know you're all in for Beef O'Brady. So if you're
totally, yeah, I am a Beef O'Brady's man.
So let's go back to Manziel for a second, because this summer I saw a number of stories on him that seemed to paint a picture of a possibly unhappy child star, a guy going from enjoying his fame and his celebrity to chafing at sort of being in the fishbowl of the same fame and celebrity. After reading some of those stories, I almost expected him to show up with Bubbles the Chimp on the sideline this year, just like in total full Jacko mode, you know, leave me alone.
Yeah.
I've lost my mind from being a child star, but that hasn't happened at all. I'm exaggerating, but like nothing really bad has happened. He's playing great. He seems to be having a lot of fun, much like last year. And all of the concern trolling from the summer seems to have gone away. Was the whole Johnny Manziel off season basically much ado about very little, or what happened?
Yes, it was very much ado about very little. I mean, it was a 20-year-old kid, however old he is now, who likes to party. That was the essential of it, and I think it really exposed the divide between the old school sports writers and the new school sports writers in a weird way. And I have friends in both camps, and I think there are good writers in both camps. But I think just the way that we look at these things and perceive these things, especially among the younger generation, is changing. And I think people had their say and, you know, condemned him for their reason, had their reasons for condemning him, and then realized once the season started, once that Alabama game was done, then it wasn't really much of a story anymore. So it seemed like one of these 24-hour news cycle stories where it was just people clinging on to, you know, piling their opinions onto it. And then once the story sort of died out, the people who don't have an abiding interest in college football essentially let it go. And then he was able to be himself again, and the spotlight came off him. And he is the most exciting college football player I think I've ever seen. You know, just in the way he plays and the way he moves, the way he seems capable of doing anything at any time. So I'm sort of glad that it all died down, because I think it made it easier for him to just be able to play. It was sort of fascinating how it all piled on like that, and how, you know, how many people jumped onto that story. But yeah, it's been, I mean, to me, the fascinating thing about him is the way he plays football more than anything else.
I mean, did it seem to you that people almost want him to get some sort of comeuppance for liking to party? I mean, for lack of a better way of putting it?
Yeah, I think so. And I guess that's like, that's just the way it's always going to be. It's like, you know, the older generation is always going to judge the younger generation. I do it, you know. I judge all sorts of, this internet stuff. You know, I don't understand half of it. But, you know, I think that's mainly what the story was about, was that they saw a 20-year-old kid who looked to them to be entitled, and people didn't like it. And that's just, I guess that's partly just human nature, and it's partly just the nature of media now, too, that that it was a kind of a slow time of year anyway, so people jumped on the story.
Well, speaking of liking to party, I want to take a minute to talk about Florida Atlantic and the news last week with Carl Pelini, which is something I wrote about. You know, he resigned for allegedly using marijuana. Then reports came out that he also was allegedly using cocaine.
Yeah.
Now, I wrote about the marijuana part last week, and I basically argued that the entire sports world, you know, not just college football, is too harsh on marijuana use. That recreational use, liking to party with marijuana, if you will, shouldn't be grounds for termination. That schools and leagues shouldn't be testing players for pot. that sports should maybe even consider allowing medical marijuana use instead of some of the more dangerous addictive painkillers we see. And that I felt overall the sports world seemed to be lagging behind the culture at large, which seems to be more and more in favor of decriminalization and legalization. But cocaine does strike me as different. It seems like a more harmful and dangerous drug. It's certainly more addictive and can have worse side effects. Now, again, though, maybe that's not grounds for firing someone. Maybe that's grounds for rehab and a suspension. I want to ask you, if you were in charge at Four Atlantic, and just based only on the sort of vague things that have been reported, you know, we don't know all the behind-the-scenes stuff by any means, what would you do in the case of someone like Pelini?
So I'm the athletic director in this
segment. Yeah, let's say you're the university president or you're the athletic director.
Well, okay, I'll tell you quickly. I mean, I think what happened here was if he had won 8 in a row this year, or if they were having a really good year, then they might have sent him to rehab, you know, or they might have suspended him for the rest of the season and had him go into some program or something like that. So I think there was definitely a decision that, like, this guy's in his second year. He hasn't done much for us as a coach. This is a way to dismiss him without having to pay his buyout. I think that was definitely factored into this decision. But what would I do in that case? I mean, I'm on these sorts of issues, I'm pretty liberal. So I would probably say he would have to deliver some sort of public statement explaining what had happened. And, if I have sensed that there was some sort of serious problem there, then probably send him off to some sort of rehab facility. But yeah, especially you quoted the study that said that, like, I think it's like 50% of Americans now think it should be legal. So it seems like this is going to be one of those things like gay marriage where in 20 years, I think it'll be legal in most places. Sports tends to be one of the last places to sports is a pretty conservative place in general. So I think that probably has something to do with it. But yeah, I mean, I think I would definitely be a little more cautious about the whole thing, I guess.
Well, you mentioned sports being more conservative. But I think in some ways sports has also historically been more liberal. I mean, look at things like gender equality, racial integration. Sometimes sports was, if not directly out in front of society, it was kind of right there with the curve instead of behind the curve. So I don't think it's always the case that sports is conservative.
What? You're right. It's football that's conservative.
Yes, actually, you know what? You're right. That's a really good point.
And especially college football, because you're dealing with young kids, and you know, you saw that divide in the 60s where, you know, the football team was almost seen as this militant arm of the university in a way.
Right.
And, you know, it was the, you know, the hippies versus the football team on a lot of campuses.
The hippies won in the long term, though.
They did. The hippies always win.
But when you look at the corporatism of someone like Nick Saban, his program, the hippies got co-opted too.
Well, now you have corporate hippies. I mean, look at Whole Foods. You know, that's corporate hippies right there. So, I guess that's I don't think Saban was ever a hippie, but you know, I guess you could say.
If he had been a hippie, if there was a long-haired Nick Saban photo floating out there with like just a giant mega bong, I am sure that we would have all seen it 1,000 times.
Oh, I'm sure Deadspin would have unearthed that 4 years ago if that was the case, yeah. Although he did go to Kent State, you know. Hmm. Or did he go to Kent State or did he coach at Kent State? Maybe he just coached there, I can't remember. But he has some ties to Kent State, so.
Right, I think he did coach there. Last question just on this sort of subtopic. Should college teams be testing players for recreational drugs?
Recreational drugs meaning
marijuana, pot. I don't know if alcohol gets tested for anywhere. Things like that.
You know. Talk cocaine and other drugs?
Yeah, we're not talking about steroids. So when I say recreational, I guess I mean drugs that aren't performance enhancing.
Okay. I mean, I'm sort of torn on this. I don't think anybody should be testing for pot because I think pot should be legal anyway. And I do wonder about cocaine because I've written a lot about, you know, the 80s and Len Bias and all that stuff. I do think, I mean, I hate the idea of drug testing, but in college sports, I think maybe it has been effective in that you just don't hear about a lot of players doing cocaine anymore. I mean, I know cocaine isn't as trendy a drug as it was in the 80s, obviously. But part of me wonders if maybe drug testing does work.
Maybe it had some deterrent value for the college athlete population.
I don't know if that makes it worth the civil intrusion that it presents, but I think it maybe does deter a lot of athletes from doing, especially harder drugs.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's been anything that study that would sort of show that one way or another, whether it's an attitude study, usage rate study, something that kind of tied those two things together. I mean, I think in general, if you look at statistics, the usage rates for those kind of drugs have mostly gone down, I think, among college students, with the exception of alcohol and marijuana.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just that athletes are more serious now. Maybe it's that a lot of those harder drugs, you know, kids like us grew up essentially being drilled about the dangers of those drugs.
Oh, yeah, Nancy Reagan and Mr. T, man, just say no.
Same thing. It's like, just say no kind of worked in a way, you know?
Yeah.
I'm not crazy about the ideas behind it and the fact that it distorted the truth in a lot of ways, but it worked, you know?
Well, like you said, you've written about this because you've written a lot about Len Bias, and you know, without going way on a tangent here, is that era, and especially Len Bias's death, is that sort of when we saw this kind of drug testing move into college sports and into college football and basketball? Was it a reaction to that, or was it there before?
I think they were starting to talk about it, and I think Bias and some of the other incidents helped focus it and helped them ratchet up a lot of those drug tests and the idea of drug testing. I think that was definitely a big thing, was that moment in the 80s when Bias and died and then Don Rogers died. And it caused a lot of overreaction legally, you know, not going too far down this road, but, you know, in terms of sentencing for low-level drug users and things like that. But yeah, I think in terms of drug testing, I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure that was a huge factor.
Let's switch gears. A subject that is near to dear to you and that we teased a little bit earlier, college football video games.
Oh, boy.
So thanks largely to the ongoing Ed O'Bannon antitrust case that basically threatens to blow up college sports amateurs as we know it.
Yes, and I'm blaming you for this.
Yes, okay. You know what? Like FDR, I welcome your hate. This is the last year now of EA Sports NCAA football. Like you, I'm a bit of a sports game nerd. I know that you're kind of a sports game nerd specifically for the college football game.
Yeah.
I think both of us could probably agree that, you know, the Madden game has been kind of disappointing for the last half decade. Not really that fun to play. Where are you going to go from here with your video game habit? Is it going to die with this year? Are you going to go forward with perpetual roster updates? Are you going to, with the proceeds we get from our college football NIT, are you going to fund a new college football video game? What's next for you?
Yeah, I mean, if there's enough money in that, you know, if Mark Cuban wants to come in. I don't know. I keep hoping that, like, some other company is going to step up and publish some sort of bootleg version of this. And now I find myself rooting for this lawsuit to be settled as fast as possible so that they can start making some sort of version of the game again. That's like my only rooting interest here. It's kind of pathetic, but I feel like my main rooting interest in the future of amateurism is finding some sort of way that the EA Sports college football game can exist again.
Well, see, I'm glad you said that because I think that you and most college football fans and almost everybody that plays the EA Sports games, if all of a sudden tomorrow amateurism was thrown out and EA Sports could somehow, you know, maybe they do some sort of collective licensing agreement. Again, maybe the players form some sort of union or trade association. But if EA Sports could basically pay these players directly, and actually add their real likenesses in the game, so you wouldn't have, the Johnny Manziel with like the weird sort of looks like him face and the wrong colored hair, and you have to edit a few of the things in, even though it's got, all his stats and his number.
Right.
If you actually had Johnny Manziel in the game, had a cyber face in the game, and had a bunch of other star players, and had all these other guys in the game, and money was going to these guys.
Yeah.
I don't think that anybody who likes the sport or likes the video game version of sport would have a problem with that. I know EA would be happy to pay those guys, and I think everybody would actually like it if the games were that much more realistic.
Yeah, well, it seems like it wouldn't be that hard, no matter what else the NCAA does, for them to adopt this Olympic model at some level. I mean, you know more of the details of how that would work legally than I do. But, I mean, if they did that, then they could just publish the game again right away, right?
Yeah, they could. I mean, again, if it was one of those cases where if the NCAA said it's all right for all of you to get money for your name, image, and likeness for being in this game, they could absolutely do it again. The whole reason EA is dropping out, the whole reason other companies have dropped out, is because they don't want to get involved. They're already in this lawsuit. They don't want to be liable going forward.
Right, right. So it seems like once they get this straightened out, might take a couple years, that somebody's gonna step up and start publishing this game again. And that makes me wonder if there's gonna be some other renegade or rogue video game company that's gonna try to jump in to the breach here and just say, to hell with the lawsuits, we'll just take our chances.
We need the U of video game makers. We need a renegade to come in and do it.
I know. We need to find the sort of those rebellious video game college football fans, which I don't know how many there are, but maybe they're out there somewhere.
It's rough because, I mean, the new Xbox, PlayStation, they're coming out with sort of their refresh newer consoles now. Those are coming out soon, next couple of weeks, next month or so. And, the fancier graphics, everything's going to be better in all these different kinds of games. And I'm sure that, the roster update, you can probably go at least a couple of years.
Yeah.
Playing what you're playing now, playing NCAA Football 14. But at some point, it's going to be hard when it just gets more and more dated. I mean, I don't know. People still play Tecmo Bowl, so maybe I shouldn't say that.
I know. Well, that's what I wonder. I mean, I think we go a year or two with this game. I'm going to have to figure out how to update the rosters because I'm so technically incompetent that I don't know how to actually do that.
I am sure we have a listener who will help you with that.
Yeah. I could use somebody to talk me through that. I think you're right. Within a couple of years, we're going to reach the point where it's going to seem really outdated and we'll have the new consoles and we'll have to figure out what comes next. So that's why I feel like they've got to solve this in the next couple of years. You've got to help them solve this, Patrick.
Well,
we've got to get this fixed.
I just want to note, I'm 36, and I'm closer to 37 at this point. And on top of that, that means I'm closer to 40 than I am to 30. I know that you're in my age cohort. Unless you want to give away your age, you don't have to.
Slightly older, yeah.
And I just want to know that by far the most passionate and intense portion of the podcast so far has been about the future of sports video games.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know. It's pretty weird. It's pretty weird that I've spent this much of my life playing one video game in particular. So I can't make any excuses for it. It's kind of pathetic, but it's also just so much fun. It's so much fun, and I feel like the Madden game is not as much fun.
No, it isn't. It is. It is fun. It's kind of like the old Chris Rock joke about Krispy Kreme donuts, where it's just like if someone told you that there's crack in there, you'd be like, "Yeah, I thought so."
Yeah, and I feel like it kind of mirrors. I love watching the NFL, but like I just love watching college football more. And I think I feel the same way about the college football game compared to the Madden game as I do about the actual sports. It's an interesting parallel where I think the Madden game just feels more like work to me. It feels like it's more of a chore to play it, whereas the college football game is just like endless possibilities in that one.
Well, I don't want to totally spoil your love of college football, but I'm going to bring up something that is difficult. It's actually tied into a familiar topic of mine, and the whole reason why I actually don't watch football anymore. Concussions, brain damage. I don't even want to use the term concussions. I'm going to use what it is, brain damage, because we're talking about all sorts of different types of brain damage. The NCAA is currently getting sued. There's actually a bunch of different lawsuits. They might become a class action. The association's in settlement talks, probably to try to stave that off. And I don't really blame them, because as I've written about, and other people have written about too, they've done even less on this front than the NFL has. If you read through those lawsuits, you'll see this. I mean, the NCAA has got no standard policy, no best practices, no real enforcement. Until recently, they didn't even have a rule or policy on same-day return to play if you are a football player or an athlete in any sport who is concussed in a game. Mm-hmm. Basically, the NCAA policy is this. Member schools have to have a policy on file. Now, on top of that, the new NCAA medical chief, he recently said that there was no consensus on this return to play issue until late last year. Now, I went and looked at this. He's actually cherry picking, because many, many, many medical organizations had consensus on the idea of you should not go back into playing the same day if you're concussed. They had this for years. Almost all experts recommended this. The one body that didn't, this international body that the medical chief was referring to, it's a group that had put out guidelines in 2009 saying there might be an exception to same day for certain elite athletes. If you look at their paper and why they said that, and you go to the footnote, that was based on discredited NFL research, the stuff we saw in League of Denial. Mm-hmm. One last little point on this. That NCAA medical chief I'm talking about, his name's Brian Hainlein. He used to work with Elliot Pellman in a Long Island medical practice. Elliot Pellman is the guy who is the head of the disgraced NFL concussion committee. So it's kind of an interesting coincidence there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not disagreeing with you on any of that. I think the one thing that I thought, well, there's a lot of things I thought was interesting from the League of Denial documentary. But there really is still a gap in understanding here, and it seemed like one of the things that the female doctor, I can't remember her name, was saying.
Ann McKee.
Right. Was that it seems like certain people's brains react differently than other people's brains.
Right.
Now, I don't know. I mean, I would assume anybody who has a concussion obviously needs to sit out for at least a week. But it is interesting to me that it seems like there's a lot of science here that has yet to be figured out.
That's
so
true.
Obviously, we need to be extra cautious, especially when you're dealing with high school athletes and even with college athletes, you know.
Well, yeah, that's actually my question to you was going to be, I agree with you. There is a lot of specific science that is still unknown because the brain itself is still pretty mysterious, you know. But we do know that getting hit in the head can be very bad for your brain. Getting hit in the head repeatedly can be worse for your brain. There seems to be a need for recovery and rest and repair after getting hit in the head. And if you get that proper amount, which can vary for every person, depending on, again, the threshold of getting injured in the first place, it does seem to be that you can generally have decent outcomes. Although, again, when it's repetitive and repetitive and repetitive, that seems to also be a problem. But just given, like you said, what we know, and what even knowing what we don't know, what kind of responsibility do you think these schools, conferences, and the NCAA itself has to players in terms of protection? Should they be doing more? Are they living up to what they should be doing right now?
Oh, no, I'm sure they're not. I'm sure a lot of this, as it seems like it was with the NFL, was triggered by fear of lawsuits, you know, or by fear of somehow doing the wrong thing, in a sense that, you know, I guess they want to absolve themselves from as much responsibility as possible. So I think we need to get beyond that point. I think that's the main thing that League of Denial and all the other stories can do, is to sort of get us beyond the point of denial and get us to the point where we all realize, well, something obviously is going on here. We're not entirely sure how it works or what's going on in the brain, but obviously something bad is happening to these kids' brains, and especially when they're in high school, and probably even when they're in college, it can be even worse because their brains are still developing. So, I mean, it just seems like something that they're going to have to address soon. I think, you know, part of it is that, you know, the NCAA just doesn't have a lot of power right now. And so, you know, I would, you know, it seems like it probably is up to the conferences at a lot of levels too. You know, it seems like the Big Ten, this is something that the Big Ten should be addressing if they really think that they're sort of the academic leaders of the college football world, at least of the major college football world. You know, the Big Ten should be all over this. So, I mean, you know, that's the other thing is like, what is the NCAA going to be in 5 years? Is the NCAA even going to exist in 5 years? You know? And so, yeah, I mean, I think there's just a lot of... There's still a lot of misunderstanding here. There's still a lot of people who sort of have that reactionary vibe to this whole thing where they just, you know, anything that that somehow softens football is a terrible thing and is going to ruin the game. And it's, you know, this sort of, I don't know, academic conspiracy in some way to soften football.
Right, this is the equivalent of global warming.
Yeah, essentially.
For climate change.
It really pisses me off when stuff like this becomes a political issue.
Right.
You know, because that's the last thing that needs to be, you know.
I think it's inevitable. I think it's already becoming a political issue. I mean, you can already see the cultural battle lines being drawn. If you just look at the geographic fault lines for college football. I mean, I hate to say it, but where is college football by far the most popular? And where does it sort of mean the most culturally? Where is it tied into... why is it the most tied into pride, identity, masculinity, all those things? It's in the South.
Absolutely.
Which is culturally and politically conservative. And probably the place that is, again, I hate to say, I agree with you, which this shouldn't be politicized or go into our culture wars at all, but I just can't see how it won't. I think it already has in some ways.
No, I think it already has too. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know more about exactly what the NCAA has done, and you probably have better opinions on what they should be doing, but you know, obviously I don't think any of these organizations are doing enough at this point, and I would say the only other counter argument that I would make is that I think there's a lot of science that still needs to be figured out here.
Sure. Let me ask you sort of the big picture question, the tricky question. If we're talking about an activity in football that has a lot of getting hit in the head and has a significant but as yet sort of unquantifiable, indeterminate risk level of brain damage, and again the type and the quality of brain damage, it's somewhat indeterminate. It can be not such a big deal. It can be terribly, terribly bad and change your entire life. Yeah. There's a whole spectrum in between. If that's the kind of activity we're talking about, if that's what football is, and schools, now, this is not NFL football, we're talking about colleges, are fundamentally in the business of educating young people, so in its essence, nurturing their brains, and also protecting young people because they act in loco parentis, they have a special duty and obligation to their students that once you get out of college doesn't necessarily exist. If those are sort of the two fundamental missions of a university or a college, should they be in the business of football in the first place? And do you think anyone in college football has even started to grapple with that kind of big moral question?
No, and I don't think anybody wants to. I certainly don't want to. From a fan's perspective, I don't want to. Because when you look back, this is a lot of what I'm writing about in this book, is you look back and the whole idea of college football is a pretty strange one in the first place. You know, nobody in any other country can really understand the concept of college football. And it cropped up, you know, in the Ivy League in the mid to late 1800s, and essentially you know, it began because these kids on campus were trying to blow off steam. And then what happens is the adults at the university start to co-opt it and start to turn it into, you know, a business. You know, even back then, it obviously wasn't the same sort of business that it is now. But I think they saw a purpose for it.
And didn't we see, too, you know, the progressives, Teddy Roosevelt, that kind of movement also sort of co-opted college football as this is a way to sort of build character, mold men.
Yeah, you can go back. There's an author named, I think you've probably talked to him before, a guy named Michael Oriard, who's written a bunch of books about the history of college football. And, you know, they talk about this sort of idea of manliness in the late 1800s, which is really interesting, you know, that because of industrialization, that man, the idea of what it was to be a man was sort of being marginalized, and that football was a way to fight against that. And that was a big thing for Teddy Roosevelt, you know, was this idea of manliness. You know, that's a very roundabout and wonky way of saying that. I don't think there's any easy way to reconcile the idea of college football as a whole.
But people don't really want to try to reconcile that. It seems like they've already made their minds. We don't really need to reconcile that. We'll just keep going forward with it. Mike, are you there?
Hello?
Hey, man, we got a little delay there.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's okay. I'll just pick up in a couple seconds. So okay. I'll just be silent for a second. So, yeah, so it seems like what you're saying is almost that there's been this tension from the beginning of, you know, what is sort of the place and purpose of having football in college. And in some ways, what we're seeing now with brain damage and concussions, the question of does this mean that we should or shouldn't have college football isn't totally different than that asking that question the whole way, the whole time we've had college football.
I think it's been the same question the whole way through. One of the first scenes that I read about in the book is there's a guy at Yale in the early 1900s. I think it was like 1905. He's like 24 years old. He comes out of this prep school. And Yale recruits him, and then he winds up becoming a cigarette salesman. He's essentially endorsing a brand of cigarettes at this local that they sell at this local diner. And so the cigarette company essentially co-ops this guy to become an endorser for their cigarettes. You know, so it's the same kind of thing that's, you know, happening 100 years later with Johnny Manziel. And, you know, obviously the whole idea of concussions is a new thing, but you go back to the early 1900s and you had Teddy Roosevelt, you know, having his conference at the White House about, you know, whether college football was too dangerous. There were a bunch of players dying back then. And that was when the NCAA was actually formed, was to help with players, specifically to help with player safety. So it's kind of interesting that they're, you know, largely absent here.
You know, it's one of the great ironies, I think. And also, you know, in sort of, you're saying players were dying of college football. They were dying essentially of skull fractures, which eventually gave us these hard plastic helmets, which in some ways have given us the ability to endure and cause the kind of brain damage we're seeing now. So there's a lot of sort of historical ironies. I'm glad you brought that up.
It's fascinating to look back. I mean, that's what's so fascinating about college football in general. It is a complete and utter hypocrisy. It is corrupt. It is politically driven. But yet, I love it so much more than any other sport that I can't even put it into words, you know? And maybe it's just a quintessentially American thing that it's so screwed up in the way it is.
Well, let me get you out of here on a loving college football question.
Okay.
There's three big games this week. Oregon-Stanford, Baylor-Oklahoma, those are Thursday night, and then we've got Alabama-LSU on Saturday. Now, I know you're going to Alabama-LSU. I know you're going to write about it for Sports on Earth, of course. Ka-ching. Yeah. Of those games, which do you think will be the most intriguing? Yeah, which one are you the most excited to watch? Even if you weren't necessarily going to write something about it.
Baylor, Oklahoma, just because I'm interested to see how good Baylor actually is. I know how good Oregon is. I think Stanford could still beat them. And I know how good Alabama is. I don't think LSU will beat them. But Baylor, I just don't know. Baylor's the one game where they could blow out Oklahoma by 40 points, or they could lose by 20 points. You know, it could really go either way. So, yeah, if I would say if you're a casual college football fan, which you probably haven't been listening to a 90-minute podcast with me if you're a casual college football fan, but that would probably be the game that you'd want to see first, because Baylor is fascinating.
Right. And you but you'll be at Alabama LSU.
I
Any
will.
quick thoughts about that going in? What are you gonna be looking for?
I imagine Alabama is so surgical this year, and LSU is a little bit up and down. It's hard to see anybody beating Alabama at this point, at least until they get to maybe to a national championship game. You know, Auburn's really good this year, so maybe Auburn can beat them down the line. But it seems like they're better than LSU this year. And I'm curious. I actually just want to go just to see how good they really are, and just to see what it looks like at this point, and just kind of get a sense of what the atmosphere is down there.
You're going to be a witness to the process.
I will be a witness to the process. Maybe I will get a sense of what it would be like to coach on Mars.
Ask you know what, if you could squeeze in a Mars question into the post game, you'll be my hero
Oh,
forever.
I'm going to throw a Mars question in there and get the death stare from Nick Saban.
Well, you know, at least you know he might even step right over you on the way out the door like he did in Miami.
Who knows?
Michael Weinreb, Sports on Earth college football writer. We are out of time. Before we go, really quickly, tell people how they can follow you on Twitter.
You can follow me on Twitter by, if you can spell my last name, which is Weinreb. It's actually Michael Weinreb.
No
Yeah, that's
underscore,
it.
nothing like that, just at Michael Weinreb.
Nothing like that. I keep it simple on the Twitters. You know, I am, you know. I don't know. It's Twitter. Whatever.
Hey, don't knock Twitter. Twitter's great for our profession.
I am, yeah. We'll have to have another podcast about that, but yeah.
Well, maybe we're great for Twitter, actually providing them free content. Maybe I have it all backwards.
Exactly.
All right. Well, good podcast today. That's been Michael Weinreb, Sports Enough college football writer. I am Patrick Ruby. And as always, for Sports on Earth, I'm saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.